Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
I'm Brian Kenny, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, they've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Pico Oysters, turning water into brine on Long Island's North Fork.
Hello, I'm Diane Stemple, and today I want to welcome in studio Mike Edison, author of the memoir, You Are a Complete Disappointment.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, how
Thanks
are
for
you?
Me.
He's also another host on Heritage Radio Network of Arts and Seizures, correct?
Well, was.
Was. And it was from, we think, 2011 to just last August.
250 shows. That's a lot of pizza.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we started, I think 2011.
Uh-huh. Did you always have the same co-host?
No, we started with my pal Judy McGuire.
Right,
and,
I remember.
Judy's not also a great writer, and about halfway through, we sort of, the show started, in fact, as the Mike and Judy Show for old-time mm-hmm. listeners who remember, and we sort of changed it a little bit. We called it Arts and Seizures
mm-hmm.
For the last half, and Pete Zaremba, a fabulous frontman of famous rock and roll band, the Fleshtones. He sort of came in as a guest co-host one day, mm-hmm. and I couldn't really get rid of him. He kind of hung around for the next 120 shows.
You really couldn't get rid of him.
And having Pete was great, because having a co-host like Pete kind of obviated the need for guests.
Oh, great.
I know, because guests are so annoying.
We'll see how annoying
my dream is to do a show where the host changes every week, but I'm the only guest, like every week. Much easier being a guest than it is being the host.
Ah, okay. But then the host can't control you. You don't want to be controlled.
Diane, you'll never tame me.
Okay, so as my listeners know, I frequently divert from strict cheese books to do various other genres, often meat or politics, but I have begun to investigate food memoirs and or just plain memoirs, which I think this is. So, Mike.
Oh, there's nothing plain about it, Diane. Come on.
Oh, I didn't mean that. But it's not a food memoir.
Well, it was a food component.
Yes, yes.
I mean, as part of like the many ways my mother ruined my adolescence, food was certainly one of them.
I don't even think that was in the top five. Anyway, okay, how would you describe this book?
Oh, it's called You Are a Complete Disappointment, which
yes.
were my father's last words to me, literally on his deathbed. Through an oxygen mask in a hospital room in Scottsdale, Arizona, where he was clearly, on his last lap, and our relationship was pretty strange to begin with. But I flew out there to see him. It was Father's Day. My brother said, "Yeah, you should probably come out. You know, I'm getting the vibe. It'd be a good idea if you came out."
Mm-hmm.
And
but that was a secret that your brother told you to come out.
Yeah, it was really well. He wasn't supposed to tell me that my father was sick. He said, "Don't tell Michael." And he's like, "What the fuck?" You know, it was like, you're sick and you're in the hospital. I'm not supposed to tell him. And
right.
He goes, "Well, why don't you tell him?" And my father's like, "Ah, oh, you should call me. And the reason I didn't call him, because I think the last time I had called him before that, he told me, you know, that I was stupid. No one really cared what I had to say. And so I wasn't really encouraged to, you know,
call him again.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of a running motif, you know, just sort of like being slapped down whenever I did reach out. Because one tries to be a mensch. One tries to call their folks once in a while, even even under duress. But it was, it had just reached the point with him that, like, what was really the point? Anyway, so I did call him. I said, hey, I'm thinking of coming out for Father's Day. And he put on a very cheery voice. That's great. I can't wait to see you. Complete bullshit, of course. But maybe not. Maybe it wasn't bullshit, because when I got there, he was loaded for bear, even though he was in bed with, you know, a million machines hooked up to him. And he said, come here. Something, I'm glad you're here. There's something I wanted to tell you.
Not like, I love you, I'm sorry, I've ruined your life.
I'm proud of you. That wasn't happening.
No, not happening.
No, I mean, it's like, you know, come here, kid. Something I want to tell you. Yeah, Dad. You're a complete disappointment. And he was just getting started. I mean, he obviously had thought this through.
He went on.
Oh, my God. I mean, and at that point, I just sort of took it, you know, on the chin, because what am I going to do, get into a fight with, like, a dying man with an oxygen mask on?
Right.
But, I mean, he was, like, his eyes were lighting up, and the mask was getting filled with spittle, and he went on and on about, you know, no one wants to read your books, and, you know, you haven't done anything, and no one wants to hear your band. And also, you're the only person in the family who's fat. I know.
Just to throw that in.
This is that whole Woody Allen thing about, like, comedy is tragedy plus time.
Right, I mean, it's very funny, but
at the time it totally sucked.
Oh. Well, my next question after how would you describe the book was, do you feel comfortable telling the story from where the title comes, and clearly you do feel comfortable telling it.
Well, that's the one thing the old man did give me, is he gave me a great story to tell.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even afterwards, like, really? That, you know, I mean, that's what he said, and I would tell people, and they'd be like, oh, my God, and they would kind of laugh, and they'd say, I'm sorry.
Like, to
a person. They would laugh and say, I'm really sorry you had to go through that. And they said, really? He said that? And they start cracking up again.
Right. The subtitle is a bit more cheerful, A Triumphant Memoir of Failed Expectations.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
So you failed his expectations, not yours.
I think if there was anybody who was a disappointment in this relationship, it weren't me. And, you know, and this speaks directly to having expectations for your kids or for anyone. I mean, if you have these high expectations, I mean, you're only going to be disappointed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So the failed expectations... you know, listen, my brother is, one guy's a mocker on Wall Street, the other guy's a lawyer, and I dropped out of film school to become a musician and ended up working for magazines like High Times and Hustler. So I didn't really fill the expectations my parents might have had. I didn't provide them with a narrative that would have been useful, you know.
At their parties.
Yes.
Or they didn't really have
parties. They didn't
really
have parties. No, they lived in fear of having fun. I mean, they really were miserable. I mean, God bless my mom. My mom was very difficult. We had a strained relationship, but we ended on the very best possible note.
Don't tell me that story yet.
Okay,
that's for the end. Okay, EGADS. My listeners may know that my day job is a therapist.
I know. I was all psyched to, like, lay on a couch here while we did this interview.
There aren't any couches in this.
Matt, get a couch.
Oh, yeah, we want a couch.
I'm on Amazon right now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
A fainting bed, something like a fainting couch. What do you call that?
Yeah, that's what I have. So I've spent my life listening to stories of bad parenting, but this one may take the cake. I'm sorry to say.
I mean,
the deathbed, the pronouncement.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
He did it on purpose.
Yeah.
I mean, this was not a slip.
Oh no. And how fucked up do you have to be, really? Like, this is like, you want to spend your last breath, you know, screaming at your kid.
I mean, you want
to carry that kind of anger around. And that's the kind of, you know, that's the car you want to ride out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Is like one that's fueled by anger. I mean, like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the whole spiel, you know, was, I can't believe someone as smart as you likes professional wrestling.
Why does he even care? Well,
this was a real thorn in his side.
I like professional wrestling.
You know, I am a totally unrepentant, unapologetic wrestling fan.
Mm-hmm.
And
still?
Yes. In my heart of hearts, of course I am. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm a rock and roll fan too. That doesn't necessarily mean I got to listen to the records that are coming out this year, but I'm never going to stop, you know, thinking Little Richard is like the greatest thing that ever happened, you know, to the human race. So, yeah, I'm a wrestling fan. But I worked for wrestling magazines, too. That's important to the story. Mm-hmm. It was my first job when I dropped out of school. Mm-hmm. Was I got a gig working for a wrestling magazine, and ended up being very good for me. I made money. I was young. Mm-hmm. I was working in an office. I got chops together. I learned how to be a magazine editor because...
And
honestly,
you got to pay attention to wrestling and get paid for it.
Oh, so that was a good time to be. I was 24. I had this office in the Empire State Building.
Oh, cool.
And we used to go to the matches, and we used to like hang out with some of the wrestlers afterwards. I mean, you know, it was great because I was just writing whatever I wanted to and was learning how to put together a magazine. Mm-hmm. And it led to other magazine gigs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never made it to Condé Nast. That's okay because I don't think either of us really wanted to, you know.
Meet up.
Mr. Condé's and Nast. Or me. Yeah, we're not. You know, that's not a love connection.
Okay, so your story is pretty much the story of your childhood and then some of the therapy you needed to get over your father's deathbed awfulness. Did you try therapy before that?
I was the last Jew in New York not to have a shrink.
Ah.
And in fact, it was Judy McGuire, the co-host of the Arts and Seizures, who suggested it was, you know, I was having, it wasn't just my dad dying. I was having a bad summer, the summer of suck.
What year was it?
So that was, it was about 5 years ago, I guess.
Okay.
It was about five or six years ago. Mm-hmm. So I'd lost my job. I had a terrific job.
Before the deathbed?
This was all sort of happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. I get all like just piled on. It was like I lost my job. I had a really good job as a senior acquisitions editor for a book publisher. I'd kind of reinvented myself as in the book publishing business versus the magazine business. Great gig. Mm-hmm. And they kind of let me go. This is like, you know, just the financial situation of the world is, you know, everything, you know, sort of catching up to the publishing business. Mm-hmm. My girlfriend dumped me. Who I was crazy about. I was really brokenhearted.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, this whole bit with my dad telling me I'm a loser.
And dying.
And all of a sudden, yes.
So you can't argue.
Well, who's to argue? And, you know, I was thinking like, oh, fuck, here I am. Single, unemployed guy with cat. And the cat died.
And your cat was very special.
Oh, Manly, the world's strongest cat. That cat was very popular. He had a very big cult following. The world's strongest cat.
I mean, you loved him.
I do love my cats. Yeah. And Manly, though, was like one in a million. He was a cat that, I mean, he was compared to Bill Clinton and Elvis Presley in the charisma department. I mean, we used to have parties at my house, and the cat would just sort of own the room. You know, he had this way of like Bill Clinton of making you feel like you were the most important person. Mm. And he would go over, he'd work the room, and be like, "Your cat's amazing." It's like wow. It's like, you know, he knew what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I was just like completely, you know, just
so
a little overwhelmed.
So did he die young?
No,
oh.
No, he lived all nine lives. I mean, he was like 18 or 19, but he had been sick and gotten better, and I mean, he went through. He was in the hospital for like a couple of nights at one point. I mean, he woke up in a pool of blood, and I rushed him to the hospital. And the nurses were all like, Manly, when he was leaving the hospital, they didn't really figure out what was wrong, but he got better miraculously. Like, they're like, Manly, all these like hot like nurses of the veterinarian. I'm like, yeah, he's with me. And like, yeah, whatever. Manly, here's my phone number. I'm like, I pay the bill. No,
it's
Manly.
It's a great name for a manly cat.
At the time, I didn't realize he was the world's strongest cat. It was just, I don't know, but it stuck.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was overwhelmed. It was Judy who said, hey, you should call my shrink.
Ah,
you know, there's no
so
downside.
So she lent you her shrink. So
there's no downside to talking to someone, which I learned, right?
Right.
And I said, you know, maybe, like I said, maybe all those other Jews,
know what they're doing.
So I called Dr. Head Shrinker, as I affectionately call her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know how it is, Diane, doctor, Stemple, she advocated for me and reminded me that I wasn't a disappointment and sort of listened to, you know, I was able to kind of like unload and unpack all this stuff and, you know.
Now, was it an anxiety attack that convinced you
to
go or you started having them?
No,
or?
It wasn't chronic, but I did have an anxiety attack. That's I did. And I guess I wrote about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I felt like I'd been hit by a car. I was out of breath and, you know, my heart. It was just.
Did you think you were dying or did you know it was an anxiety attack? Because I think that's what's terrifying about anxiety attacks. You're like worried. This is it.
Oh, God. I didn't think I was dying. I've come much closer than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm laughing.
Well, you know, I mean, for the amount of like, you know, cocaine and booze I did in the 80s and 90s, the anxiety attack was kind of like not that traumatic after, you know, relative to how lousy I've actually felt at certain points in my life.
Okay.
But I knew what was happening. You know, I kind of realized what was happening and I couldn't, you know, it was bad, you know?
Yeah.
I deal with stress pretty well generally. Mm-hmm. And I hope that comes across in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I
think it does.
Choosing happiness is important. Mm-hmm. Choosing not to be annoyed by small things is very important. Mm-hmm. You know, choosing to pick your battles and just, you know, I mean, my parents were so the opposite.
Some people can't do it. You can, but some people just are not able to choose.
I try to keep it in the stress-free zone, because why? Mm-hmm. I mean, why? I mean, my parents, you know, they were exactly the opposite. You know, mm-hmm. if, you know, they'd order out Chinese food and it came cold, it'd be like, oh, you know, oh my God, you know, it was like this great panic situation. I'm like, what the fuck? Just heat it up.
Right.
Or call the people.
Right.
You know, like, it's whatever. This is not a problem. No one's dead.
Right.
You know, but every little thing, you know, like, you know, you get a run in your stocking and it's like, oh, you know, and your head explodes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you gotta, it's just like, you know, like no, like no, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, happiness, you gotta choose to be happy, right? I mean, I think that's the first part of it. And I hope that's sort of the message of the book as well. Mm-hmm. You gotta choose to be happy. That's the first step.
Well, I think you chose happiness all along.
Yes.
And unfortunately, your father especially resented and hated you for choosing happiness in, you know, opposed to feeling awful.
Well, he told me, he said, I didn't have fun until I was 55 years old or 60 years old when he, I'd already been a success in, you know, in business. I'm like, well, that's not my problem, you know?
Right.
I mean, you know, I've chosen, you know, obviously a different path where I've prioritized happiness. Mm-hmm. And I do work hard, and I've had some successes in my life. I've, you know, at this point, I've written a few books. I've made a few good records. I've done a few good tours of the world. I've I've loved and I've left. It's okay, you know? Mm-hmm. I spend a lot more time smiling than I do not. Smiling, which isn't to say my heart hasn't been broken and I haven't been sad or crushed or upset or depressed, of course. Mm-hmm. But I have fun everywhere I go, which was, by the way, the name of my first book.
Oh,
I have fun everywhere I go, which talked a lot about pro wrestling and pornography and punk rock and partying and all the stuff I got into in the 80s and 90s, which really, you know, pissed off my father because you see, if I were to have success going down that road, doing what I wanted to do and being true to my own self and living the life of an artist, it delegitimized his way of living, you know? Because if I weren't following the rules and I was successful at it and happy at it, what was that to say for all the time he wasted, you know, being the man in the gray flannel suit?
Right, right. Okay, we should take a break.
Well, if I could, I surely would. Standing on the rock where Moses stood. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Every chain was freedom's name. Pharaoh's army got drowned in. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Oh, Mary, don't you weep no more. Oh, Mary, don't you weep no more. Pharaoh's army got drowned in. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Well, God gave Noah the rainbow sign. I said, no more water than a fire next time.
This episode is brought to you by Pico Oysters, turning water into brine on Long Island's North Fork. Grown out of Little Peconic Bay, Pico Oysters are the only oysters based out of New Suffolk, New York. Owner, farmer, and avid fisherman Peter Stein founded Pico Oysters in 2016 after leaving a corporate job in business consulting and educational software. It's his love and passion for the area and his farm that makes eating and learning about Picos so enjoyable. Taste one and see for yourself. Learn more at PicoOysters.com. That's P-E-E-K-O Oysters.com.
So that break was Mike Edison and whom on the radio?
That was from our show. That was from Arts and Seizures. Mm-hmm. We had the great Buford Sullivan on trombone one day. Local cat plays trombone. Mm-hmm. I don't always have a trombone in my outfit. he's great. He plays with a lot of ska bands. He's kind of tours with the Scott Delight sometimes. And what's that hippie jam band? I can't remember. Anyway, if you're a good trombone player, you get a lot of calls. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was that's kind of what I do. I mean, that was the acoustic side of it anyway. Mm-hmm. But Oh Mary, Don't You Weep. It's an old kind of folk protest song from the civil rights era.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your interesting and varied career that really both your parents were not happy about.
No.
Or impressed by.
No.
But you combined music, high times, food writing, wrestling, writing smut. Can you tell us the trajectory of your career?
Straight to hell. I started at the top and worked my way down.
Okay. That's not true.
So one of my first jobs was working at this wrestling magazine, wrestling's main event, and I just sort of fell into it. I knew a guy who was working there and says, hey, you should write a story. We were all kind of like stoner wrestling fans when I was, I went to NYU Film School and we sort of, you know, that was kind of a thing. We'd get stoned and watch wrestling on Saturday mornings. And so one of the guys actually got a job at this wrestling magazine and says, hey, you should, I wrote for the school paper. He's like, hey, we'll pay you to write, you know, some of these wrestling stories, and started doing that. They paid me $100 for a story. But that was money. And, you know, you do a few of them a month, and it's nice to have some beer money, some pin money. And then before I knew it, I ended up like working there and then running the magazine. I actually beat the editor in a loser leaves town match. I actually had to chase him out of town. I destroyed him.
Him. Does that mean you took his job?
Oh, yeah. I didn't like him.
Okay.
Yeah, he was like, you know, remember the Hulk Hogan days?
Yeah.
All? You know, like stay in school, don't take drugs.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
that wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
You know, I was a heel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in wrestling, we have the good guys and the bad guys.
I was going to ask you about kayfabe.
Kayfabe, yeah.
How do you pronounce it?
Kayfabe.
Kayfabe.
Which is, yeah.
And what does it mean?
The central axis upon which my world turns.
Right. You mention it a lot in
the book. Well, okay. Well, I think it's a great metaphor, and especially in these troubled times
phony?
In which we live. Well, kayfabe is the idea, it's the concept of what you see is real. It's maintaining the illusion of reality. And so in wrestling, if you see an Iranian oil sheik battling a sadistic Marine drill sergeant, okay, you need to know that when he goes home, he's still an insane Iranian oil sheik and the other guy's actually a Marine drill sergeant. What you're seeing is real. And if someone breaks their neck in the ring, it's legit as opposed to a work. Okay. Everything that you see
is real
in wrestling.
But it's
that's
not
the kayfabe. Well, of course
it's not.
Because you're being worked.
Okay.
That's
being
all then.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
Of course, you know, I mean, the Indian chief, you know, isn't actually an Indian chief. He's an old Italian guy from the Bronx wearing a bunch of feathers on his head back in the day when that sort of thing was acceptable. You know, but that's kayfabe. It's the illusion that what you're seeing is real.
Mm-hmm.
And in wrestling, obviously, you know, my father would say, but it's fake. Don't you know that? I'm like, well, of course everybody fucking knows it. I mean, even when I was 8, you knew that the punches were pulled. How could this possibly be real? Two men in a steel cage goring each other half to death. I mean, but it doesn't matter. You know, if you have to ask whether wrestling is real or fake, you're missing it. You're missing the point.
Mm-hmm.
Like I always say, it's what Thomas Aquinas said about faith.
Mm-hmm.
If you get it, no explanation is necessary. And if you don't, no explanation will do.
Mm-hmm.
And such it is with wrestling. I mean, everybody knows that.
A lot of wrestling real?
Again, you're asking the wrong question. You know, Romeo and Juliet, is it real? Well, it certainly speaks to a lot of truths, you know. But you know what's not real? Fucking the Death Star, you know, and Darth Vader.
Okay.
Who cares?
Okay.
I mean, it's not relevant. It's an entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone sort of gets that. Though I do love wrestling because it works as a very wonderful metaphor for lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
But the evil Russians, you know, aren't really communist. I hate to break it to everybody, you know. And Hulk Hogan really is a jerk, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Is he still around?
Yeah, ish. Well, I don't know. Well, he owns Gawker now, right?
Oh, okay. Now, you mention often in the book that your father was jealous of you, that you could be unique and pursue your interests, and he tried to squash your confidence and talk you out of your interests.
Yeah.
Which is... You know, like he read the bad parenting handbook.
Do you see this a lot in your line of work?
Yes, I do. I do. So describe to me the meatball pizza incident.
Ah, the meatball pizza incident.
Because we're eating a pizza here.
I know. And this is a great. And look, in your cheese show, we got the pizza with no cheese. The Pizza Rosso, which is one of my favorites here. And, you know, 250 shows at Roberta's, that is a lot of pizza. And this is always was one of my favorites. People I know like pizzas piled up with lots and lots and lots and lots of things. But to me, this is so simple and elegant. And I find it makes the wine taste very good.
I love tomato sauce.
And I love the, you know, it might be nice to hear some anchovies. But I'll tell you, so the meatball pizza story, though.
Okay. So how old are you? Eight, nine, maybe.
At the White Birch Inn, which is, I guess, in Plainfield, New Jersey, or Woodbridge, New Jersey, up around where Routes 1 and 9 meet, and it was pretty scuzzy area. And this is like a bar. I can't believe we're going here, because it says cocktail lounge on the side of it, which is a thing my parents would avoid at all costs. You know, and it looks like this bunker, and, you know, people are smoking, and, you know, it's weird. It's not like a family. I mean, well, I guess one side is a family pizza race, but the other place is like where, you know, it's kind of like a pickup joint.
But it was the neighbor's idea, right?
Right. So
they liked the pizza.
Because they
there.
Said this pizza was amazing. It was like the first thin crust pizza anybody had ever tasted. You know, this is like 1975. And I'm shocked because we had never driven anywhere to get pizza. Pizza was just a thing. And the idea that it could be good or bad. I mean, I knew. I mean, you know, Tony's pizza was, at the time, I think 65 cents a slice. It was okay, you know, but at least this joint was clean. You know, he had, everything was spelled right on the signs. This is what, you know, what you see in pizza joints, you know, on Amboy Avenue, you know, 1975. Nina's, I think the slice was like 40 cents at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but the place was a little dirty and the signs were written in crayon. It was a little scary. But you know, in retrospect, I think their pizza might have been better. I don't know. But this was a place, they were all, oh my God, this pizza's good. So the fact that we actually drove to get pizza was beyond anything that I'd ever done in my life. So already a blue ribbon day. Anyway, the Bernsteins, our neighbors, say, you got to get the meatball pizza. And I'm okay. Like, what? Meatball pizza? Meatball pizza? Like,
this is the mid-70s.
This is like an advancement in culture I had not been aware of. Yeah,
so you are immediately intrigued.
Of course, yes. The meatball pizza. I mean, who wouldn't be?
Yeah.
This was like, I'm like, how do they get the meatballs on the pizza? Why don't they roll off?
I like meatball pizza now.
I know. I love a meatball. And so we had the meatball pizza. So they ordered the pizza. And my parents, who order probably plain pizza, it's very, very tight. They never understood the idea of family dining or sharing at home. We never really, even having like normal family dinners, it was usually everybody inhaled their food and yelled at each other and then split. But to eat with another family, even at like Chinese restaurants, you know, you usually order stuff for the table. You share. But my parents aren't great sharers. They didn't understand the concept of food as a, you know, if the kitchen is the hearth and as a center of like community and enjoyment and sharing and bringing people together. None of those things that obviously, you know, Heritage Radio stands for. Anyway, so they said, try the meatball pizza. This is Mrs. Bernstein. And I'm like, yes, I must try this pizza. And my father said no and practically slapped out of my hand. That's not your pizza. That's their pizza. And Mrs. Bernstein was very soft-spoken and nice woman. You know, it's like, you know, just let them try the pizza. It's like, it's okay. No, we can buy our own food. And you gotta understand, this is like me and my two little brothers who are now like getting a little upset because it's turning bad very, very fucking quickly. Mm-hmm. And they have two little kids. One who's got this horrible speech impediment who's like bleeding like a sheep, right? Right? He's like, it's getting a little louder and weirder, right? And I'm like, let me try the meatball pizza. And, you know, and it just hands it to me and my father's yelling because, you know, and he's also like keeping track of how many like root beers everybody has, and you know, it's you know,
he's not a good sharer.
No, and really uptight. And Elton John was playing on the jukebox. That was a very clear memory to me. Uh-huh. I loved Elton John, Benny and the Jets. And this is on the other side where the cocktail bar was, where all these guys were in cologne and gold chains. I'm sort of looking over this. I'm like, hey, you know, something's going
There's
on over there.
There's another world over there.
And, yes. And it was like, you know, and everyone in there was going to have sex with everyone else. You could just tell. I was eight and I just knew it. Like all these ladies with the big hair and the blue eyeshadow and these guys with like leisure suits and gold chains, you know. You know, I mean, you knew something was going to happen. So, you know, and I wanted to be part of that, you know, when I was ready for it, a couple years away, you know, maybe when
well,
I was
Well, you
like,
at least wanted the meatball.
But I got the meatball pizza. I just said, fuck it. I just took it. I put it in my mouth. And, you know, wow, meatball pizza. This was like everything.
Was it delicious?
Everything great and glorious about the world in which we live at one bite. Of course it was. It blown 8-year-old's fucking mind, a piece of meatball pizza. you know.
Your first ever.
Oh, man. It was so good. But why would you stop a kid from having a piece of meatball pizza?
Right.
You know, and this is, you know, what my father never got.
If your little brothers had reached for it, it would have been as cataclysmic?
Oh, it's a good question. They're little kids, so.
They were too little to reach.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Diane, in Dr. Stemple.
Yes.
I've discovered that all children have different parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right? My brother's experience with my parents is much different than my experiences
right,
with them.
Right.
Might as well have grown up in a different family.
Right. Right.
And, you know, the meatball pizza incident was like the worst fight my parents. My mother, by the way, was like, let him have the pizza. Let him have the pizza. I mean, they were divorced from 3 years after that.
must have been mortified.
She was mortified.
I mean,
we were starting a fight. My father was screaming.
A fuss about
a piece of pizza.
Sharing pizza.
You're talking about two families and a couple of pieces of pizza. They probably cost like $6 at the time, you know, 1975.
Okay. Well, I think that describes well your father's ridiculousness.
Yeah, of course. I mean, my parents, both of them lived in fear, but they lived in fear of the meatball.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. They lived in fear of carbohydrates. They lived in fear of sugar. They lived in fear of fat. They lived in fear of, you know, cocktails and booze. They lived in fear of strippers jumping out of cakes. I mean, you know, anything that would have been fun, or especially with my father, like the wrestling thing, considered lowbrow. That's why he hated it so much. You know, my Ivy League educated father thought that the fact that I liked wrestling, I didn't really explain this before, was like this huge chink in his genetic armor that he could probably produce something that like professional wrestling.
Right.
But the fact is, I also like, you know, Beethoven and Mozart and Duke Ellington and Picasso and things that are, you know, would be considered highbrow or whatever. But, you know, I also like Black Sabbath and wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, and I, whatever, I like girly magazines and smoking dope. But it doesn't, you know, never stop me from going to the Met and, you know, digging the Italian Renaissance either. My father never understood that.
Right.
You know, that all these things all live on a continuum, that it's all the same. The difference between the Three Stooges and King Lear isn't that much.
Right. But he wasn't encouraging of music. He wasn't encouraging of photography. He wasn't encouraging.
Well, he was in competition with me.
Yes. He
have you seen that? Parents in competition with their kids?
Yes, of course. He squashed you whenever he could.
Yeah. And can you imagine getting off on that, putting down your kid? What kind of sick fuck do you have to be?
I don't know if he got off on it. He believed it. You know, he...
Oh, you know, I never really put it in those terms until just this moment getting off on it. And I have to think about it because, but if, you know, I can't say it brought him joy, but it definitely reinforced his position as the alpha or, you know, because he was a bully,
the top
too.
Dog. The
you
top
know?
Dog.
I mean, he was a bully. And one thing I learned when I went to see Dr. Headshrinker, I said to her, I said, well, you know, Dr. Headshrinker, it's not like I've been abused. And she said, no, you're wrong. It's exactly like you've been abused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. This is abuse.
Yeah.
It's just.
Just because he didn't like beat me.
Verbal.
You know.
It's not physical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it stung. It left a scar. Of course it did.
Now I have another question. I don't get why the boy who bullied you in school affected you so greatly when your father was killing you every other day.
Well, it's piling on, but that was the worst. I was the hardest part of the book to write. That was harder to write about that.
I mean, I
even
knew,
now it's hard to talk about.
I know. I don't want to even ask you about it.
It's easier to talk about my father on his deathbed than it is getting beaten up when I was 9 years old.
Yeah.
Or maybe I was a little older by then. Maybe I was like 13, 12 or 13.
Yeah.
But because that's humiliating, to be beaten up in front of a bunch of kids and he, you know, and I'd saved up for this cool army jacket, you know, and he took it off me like, you know.
It was nothing.
You know, I mean, it questions in everything, my ability to defend myself, my self-worth, you know, as a man, as a person, you know, all these things. It's humiliating. And you get punched in the fucking head. You go home and, you know, and what do you do? I can't fight back. I mean, it's just, it's beyond demoralizing. I mean it was absolutely the worst. And then the kid's going to be there in school the next day.
Right.
You know, and I really do empathize with kids who've been bullied, and my God, it's not like I would thought about bringing a gun to school, God forbid, or anything like that. But sure as shit, I thought about like cutting that guy's head off and putting out a spike in my front fucking lawn. Of course, I did. But wouldn't you?
Yeah. But I might have been thinking about killing my father too.
No, patricide was never really.
That was not
on the agenda.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's a line I won't cross.
Okay, I thought it was also interesting that you found out your dad lied about finishing grad school.
Yeah, that's it was weird because he was. Oh,
and that was at the end of the book.
Yeah, when I went to look into it, you know, I just want you know, I sort of heard that. I wanted to confirm this. It was just like, oh, someone's you know, anyway, my father went to Brown and he went to MIT, you know, for the business school there, which. And then he got like a very good job. I mean, listen, at that time, you think he graduated grad school or didn't graduate, as it turns out, because he didn't write the final paper, which is very hypocritical for a guy like, you know, who's all
like
yelling,
him.
You're finish your assignment, do your homework. Yeah. And there's nothing more important than homework. And, you know, I mean, school. I'm all for education, not so much for school. It was really weird to find out. It took a couple phone calls to call the bursar and say who I was, and they sent me the records right away. And, you know, it wasn't all that. You know, all these things that I had been told.
Yeah.
I had been like, really? You dropped out in the last lap?
Right.
He was in a real rush to get married,
and,
apparently.
Yeah, why was he in such a rush?
Because, this is going deep now.
Okay.
Here we're going deep.
Okay. Was your mother going to dump him?
No, but I think he was desperate for love. I think his parents were very cold.
Okay.
I don't know that she was going to dump him. I don't know what she was doing with him in the first place. I mean, my mom was kind of a catch. I mean, a very, very pretty girl, you know, in those years. I don't know. I mean, I think the guy was very, he probably lived in fear that she would run away.
Had they not, do you know if they'd had sex before they
really?
Were married?
Really? You want to talk about my parents having sex? Really? Really? Matt, do you have the fainting couch yet? Is it here yet?
Where's I'm staying out of this.
Where's the fainting couch? Okay.
Okay.
Can I give me a drink from the bar?
Okay.
Oh, well, no, you know what? I have no fucking idea. And I'll tell you what else. I have no idea if, you know, before they were married, they were ever with anybody else or whether they're a virgin.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Of course, the thought has crossed my mind to some degree where they were with this. Or I mean, I don't see my father having any game. You know, I can't see this jerk going out on a date and being suave with a girl. He took her to see the Boston Pops.
Right.
That was a very big deal. My mom grew up in relative poverty, actually, really had to work their way into the middle class. Her parents did not have money, and her dad, my grandfather, who was a pretty great guy, he opened up a camera shop with his brother, and they kind of worked their way, like I said, you know, worked their way out of the lower rungs of the, you know, socioeconomic strata, such as it was in the 60s. But, you know, the 60s were great. You could make some money if you were willing to work. I mean, it was an economic boom time in the States, and especially for my dad, who had a college degree. You know, I mean, you could make a lot of money. Housing was cheap and affordable. There was plenty of it. There were plenty of jobs. Unemployment was like 1%. There was 0% inflation for years and years. And it was, you know, you could do it. So I guess my dad took on dates, but who the fuck knows? I don't know. They think they were finger banging at the Pops? I don't know.
I don't think so. Not there.
They played a lot of tennis.
Before?
My dad was a big tennis player. I mean, was part of his prep school veneer, a lot of tennis. And my mom, growing up poor, never played tennis, but she turned out to be an amazing tennis player. Like a great tennis player. Like really.
Yeah.
And like could kick my father's ass.
Well, that's good. So tell us the happy ending.
Well,
the happy ending about your mom, because we'll end on a good note.
Well, the real happy ending is I'm here having this conversation with you, Doc, because you know I got through this and I'm happy and I'm in a good place, and that's the happy ending.
Okay,
is that you know I'm here to tell people they should choose happiness and that you shouldn't be defined by your parents' expectations, and that if I you know. And also to parents, you know, if you're expecting your kid, if you have this idea that they're all going to grow up and be Supreme Court justices, get the fuck over it now. And you shouldn't value your child's worth, you know, by what sort of job they have. I don't know. I mean, listen, I don't lie, cheat, or steal. You know, I've always been able to support myself honestly, sometimes questionably, but always honestly. And what's that worth? My brothers would ask me, so do you consider yourself a success? And I would say, sure. And how do you measure that? Because they really want to know how much money I have in the bank. But really, it's like, well, I ask you, how much time do you spend smiling? Because also, I've created a lifestyle where I don't have to. I mean, I know you're making a lot of money on Wall Street, dude, but you get up at 4:30 every morning. I wouldn't last one day with that schedule. And I really, my happiness isn't based on what kind of car I have in the driveway either. I mean, I get it. If that's what you want, God bless you. As long as you know, you love your children and don't beat your wife. I guess that's a good leaping off point. But that's part of it. So that's the happy ending. But with my mom at the very end, you know, my mom got sick too. And my dad died of cancer. And then my mom got sick about a year later. And me and my mom, she didn't really understand the choices I made. But I started to realize that she had been overwhelmed. by, you know, sort of being left with these three unruly kids. My dad was very absentee once my parents got divorced. Mm-hmm. He's very cold. He's, you know, kind of emotionally bankrupt. I don't want to go as far as to say he's a sociopath, but he definitely lacks empathy mm-hmm. and thoughtfulness. Mm-hmm. He's a narcissist, certainly. And my mother was overwhelmed. And, you know, it's a shame. She really wasn't equipped. I mean, I wasn't the worst kid. I got into a few scrapes, but mm-hmm. nothing too bad. And I never, no. But she didn't understand it. Like, why are you still playing in a punk rock band? Or mm-hmm. or why is this magazine about pop that you're working for? You know? And listen, the High Times thing was both good and bad for me. But, I was the publisher of High Times, a very famous magazine. I made a lot of money in those years. I bought an apartment mm-hmm. in those years. Mm-hmm. You know, I bought a Manhattan apartment because of my stupid pot magazine. Mm-hmm. And all the pornography I was writing. I wrote a lot for Penthouse Letters on and off in those mm-hmm. years. See, that's an example of kayfabe. Penthouse Letters.
Now, I did not know that.
Dear Penthouse.
Oh, I never thought these letters were true
until one day I got on the crosstown bus, you know. And I want them to be true. But of course you do. Of course you do. And I want there to be a Death Star and a Jedi Knight, too. But I wrote a lot of Penthouse Letters, and at the time, you know,
you write them in different voices? Would you be male? Would you be female?
No, always male, but uh-huh. always I try to hone close to reality because mm-hmm. that's the best thing to do. Mm-hmm. And if I told about, you know, fucking some cooker in some hotel in Moscow, mm-hmm. you better believe that hotel existed. You know, I mean, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, honor among thieves and all that. Mm-hmm. What is it Bob Dylan sang? To live outside the law, you must be honest. Anyway, my mom came around at the very end. I mean, I think she knew me to be a pretty thoughtful person, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And we went down to visit her in Florida, where she lived and where mm-hmm. she was also had an oxygen mask on. She, the cancer doesn't care how good you are at tennis. My mom was an athlete and she, she just ate like broccoli and salmon because she thought it was healthy. I'm sure the salmon she was eating, though, was like the worst sort of salmon. And the broccoli was the worst sort of like pesticide-laden Monsanto core crap.
But it didn't necessarily give her cancer.
No, but I don't think it was helping either. Right. And I definitely think all the aspartame that she ingested because she was like dieting and eating all this artificial sweeteners. Right. Mom, you'd be better off with just eating the sugar. I mean, you really would be. Right. Anyway, the cancer doesn't give a shit that she was in great shape. And she got sick and didn't take too long before she died. She had mm-hmm. a little bit of a cough. Mm-hmm. Kind of like I have. And she went in, they found a little spot, and mm-hmm. 11 months later, she was dead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it happened fast, you know?
Wow.
She was kind of uptight, you know, all her life, and I was hoping that, you know, that maybe, you want someone to find joy. You want to go to her house mm-hmm. and say, Mom, you should smoke a joint and listen to Bob Marley. This will definitely extend your life.
Right.
But she couldn't see through that. But when I went down there with my girlfriend to visit her.
She loved the girlfriend.
My shiksa girlfriend, uh-huh. right? First thing she does is turn off the Fox News, the girlfriend, right? Mm-hmm. And she says to my mom, you can't heal this kind of anger in the room. Mm-hmm. You know, Bill O'Reilly was yelling about God knows fucking what. Mm-hmm. And she just went over and turned it off and said, and gave mother a hug. And said, you can't heal this kind of anger. And it changed my mom's demeanor immediately. And she gave my mom a big hug, and my mom was like, wow, you know, there's all this love coming out of like the Michael's wing, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. of this organization. Mm-hmm. And she called up, like, my brother's like, Michael made me happy, you know. She goes, my brother's like, oh, he made your day? Made my day. He made my life. And my brother's like, what the fuck? I'm the one with the law degree. I married the Jewish girl. Right? He comes in at the bottom of the ninth inning, you know, and he's the winner, you know. But, you know, but we're the ones that came in with, like, you know, it wasn't contrived. It's just who we are. Turn off the fucking Fox News. Mm-hmm. And if I can't talk you into Marley, maybe I can get you into some Mozart. But, Mom, mm-hmm. enjoy yourself. There's no reason to lay here making it even worse.
Right.
And
she went with it.
As far as she could, she did.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like, oh, the clouds parted and the sun started uh-huh. shining, you know, and the music swelled. And we had our moment. And that's what we rode with. That's what we went with until she died sometime later.
Good. Okay, well, our time is up. I want to thank Mike Edison and his wonderful book, You're a Complete Disappointment.
Please find me, MikeEdison.com. I'm on, I lurk on Facebook, Mike Edison, and I've got lots of other books out there in the world, too.
Yes, writing a new one?
I am, but I'm not yet willing to
divulge
just yet.
Okay.
But I'm excited about it. It's my first book. They're all kind of rock and roll books in their own way.
Uh-huh.
Even the food books are kind of rock and roll books, but this is the first book that's really about rock and roll.
Oh, cool.
So Yeah.
I mean, well, maybe you'll come on again once that one's published.
Maybe I will. And this we'll is going to be yeah, in the fall, actually. We're doing this one, cool. one quickly because I don't want the putative subject of the book to die.
Yeah, you have to.
Uh-oh. It's not about Bob Dylan.
Are they old?
Yeah, well,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
No, who isn't? But yeah, find me and.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come see me,
well,
some noise,
thank you very much for coming on the show.
Diane, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.